Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking with an internationally recognized scholar of Islam and human rights. His name is Abdullahi Ahmed An-Naim. He's professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta. Let me tell you a little bit more about him as a way of introduction. He grew up and was educated in Sudan. While he was a law student at the University of Khartoum, he was involved in an Islamic reform movement there, led by Ustad Muhammad Taha, and we'll talk more about who he was in just a moment here. He continued to be involved in this movement until the time that it was suppressed by the government in 1984, at a time when Islamic fundamentalism was taking a much stronger hold of Sudanese society and politics. He left the country in 1985, that he would be able to go back, but it became clear that the Islamic fundamentalist regime there was just too strong and it would be just too difficult for him to live there. So as a result, he accepted a position of executive director of Africa Watch, which is now the African division of the group Human Rights Watch, based in Washington. That was from June 93 until April of 95, and then he joined the faculty of Emory Law School. He was granted tenure in 1997 and became Charles Howard Chandler Professor of Law there in 1999. He has argued that the greatest challenge today to Islam, or at least to today's Muslim leadership, comes from its most extreme elements, those people who say that they're interested in fighting against Western cultural domination by imposing Islamic law. Now, he argues for a rather different approach, one that he says returns to the original message of the faith, one that is based on broad principles of both justice and equality. He's visiting the campus, will give a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon, talking on Islam and the secular state, negotiating the future of the religious law of Islam. That'll be 4 o'clock this afternoon at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. And these programs, they are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. We've been fortunate over the years to have many of the guest speakers in this series here on this program as a way of bringing them to a larger audience, people who are outside of Champaign-Urbana. But certainly if you are here in the area, you should feel welcome to attend his talk. And on this program, as always, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, we certainly welcome people's call. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
We appreciate it. Perhaps one way would be to start would be to talk a little bit about this man who was your mentor, Ustad Muhammad Taha. Tell us about him and about his ideas.
Yes. Ustad Muhammad Taha was a Sudanese Muslim Sufi in his orientation, but he was a professional engineer by training. And he was also engaged since the 1930s in issues about how can Sudan become independent. At that time, it was a British-Egyptian colony. And also cope with and deal with the issue of Islam, because Islam is central to the identity of sense of purpose and life for most Sudanese, about 70% of the total population of the country. But there was no clarity as to what that role might be. I mean, that struggle was going on since the 1930s and 40s. So Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha came up with a methodology for reforming Sharia, that's Islamic law, in a way that he said shifts back, it's a paradigm shift to the early Quran of Mecca, versus the Quran of Medina, that when the Prophet was in Mecca, he was propagating a religion of universal values of justice, of equality. But as the community evolved in Medina in the subsequent phase, the Quran and the Prophet's own work had to focus on actually the problems of that community in that historical context. So Taha's idea was mainly about shifting the focus back and from that, developing a methodology of reform to address questions specifically regarding the rights of women to equality, of non-Muslims, freedom of religion, and the question of jihad and the use of force and violence. So those are the issues that he worked with. Sudan was going through the same struggle in the 1950s and 60s when I was a student. And I was as confused as everybody else. I didn't know what to do about it, because on the one hand, I'm a Muslim. I believe in Islam and in Sharia. On the other hand, I couldn't live with certain aspects of Sharia, which I found to be unjust and irrational, impractical. And I attended a public lecture by Taha in 1967 when I was a law student. And I couldn't walk away. I mean, I just heard him speak that evening, and I just kept going back and gradually being part of the movement. And we continued to struggle to clarify the role of Sharia and also to advocate this notion of a shift in the methodology of, because Sharia is a concept and a content. The idea of Sharia is about the religious law of Islam. But what that means has always been contested and argued by Muslims.
Yeah. Well, and certainly that seems to be a kind of an argument that is going on right now, when many Muslims would say, and a lot of this, I think, is in response to their concerns about the power and the dominance of Western culture around the world, would say that it is important for Muslims to get back to basics, to get back to essential teachings, to rediscover, to go to the roots. But it seems that there is, though, disagreement among Muslims about what exactly that means. What are the essential principles?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. I think that is, and this, by the way, is not only just in this post-colonial phase. Mm-hmm. One point I might mention here is we should remember that all Muslim societies of today are, in fact, post-colonial societies, that they have all been colonized by European powers in Africa and in Asia. And the post-colonial condition is part of the way Muslims are reacting. It is not only that how their lives, their institutions, their political, the state they live with, all of this has been transformed by colonialism. So there is no way of going back to the pre-colonial. I think that is an illusion. I mean, one of the dangerous fantasies that some of the Islamic fundamentalists sort of promote is the notion that we can somehow go to the pre-colonial as if colonialism never happened. That's not going to be. The world has been transformed, and we have to deal with the world as we have it today. Now, definitely there are going to be disagreement as to what the basics are and how to interpret, how to understand them. That, I think, with every religion is the case, whether it's Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism. That struggle within every religion happens. What is rather different with the Muslim is the global scale of it, that Muslims are one-fifth of the total world population. And there are Muslims in every part of the world, in the globe, and there are, in fact, it's not really a Middle Eastern phenomenon, as most people think of Islam. It is a South Asian, it is a sub-Saharan African. And I think in each setting, these debates are going on in relation to that context and not on sort of a universal global scale. Mm. So it is legitimate that debates and contestation should continue. My concern and the work I try to do is to secure conditions for that debate to happen in a constructive, peaceful, orderly manner. So I don't believe that we can ever end controversy. In fact, I welcome controversy. I think we need controversy. But we need it to be peaceful, organized, constructive. And that has to do with the state as well as with society.
Hmm. Well, that does indeed seem to be the problem. That is, how can you have this kind of debate and have it be peaceful and constructive and not violent? Mm-hmm. Because it seems that what you're arguing for, and it is indeed the kind of thing that other people of other faiths argue for as well. They say you have got to consider the fact that the essential teachings, the scriptures, the practices came about in a certain historical period. And then you have to acknowledge the fact that now the period we live in now, it's different. So it is appropriate, important, necessary to reassess, to say what makes sense now in terms of present realities. And certainly there are people who make that kind of argument for Islam in another faith.
Yes.
At the same time, there are people within those faiths that say that's heresy, that there is no, you know, essential teachings or essential teachings, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about then or now. How do you negotiate this line between, you know, those people who make the arguments that we have revealed word of God, and it was true then and it's true now. And this argument that says we need to consider where we are now just doesn't apply.
Now, yes, exactly. That is the issue. And of course, one point I make is to try to contest the assumptions that go with those claims. When you say the revealed word of God, yes, as a Muslim, I believe that the Quran is divine. But once it enters into human consciousness and human experience, it is transformed. It is no longer divine. Mm-hmm. That is, the relevance of the divine to life as we live it in this world is that it has to, in fact, to become secularized in the process of being comprehensible and being practicable. So that this notion of when someone says that this is the divine word of God, yes, but how do we understand it? Who is understanding it? Where is he or she understanding it? All of those questions are questions of time and place. And the human agency of the believer is integral to the possibility of religion and religious belief itself. So I take human agency as central, as integral to religious experience, not something that is profane. I mean, sometimes the term secular or profane is used as if to dismiss something as unworthy or as negative. But in fact, we are secular, we are human, we are of time and place. So, and talking about heresy, I celebrate heresy. I believe that heresy is critical for the vitality and relevance of any religion. And of course, the point is that every orthodoxy started as a heresy. That there is no orthodoxy that was not a heresy in relation to the preceding orthodoxy. All the major religions, Christianity, Judaism, all of them have that phenomenon. So the possibility of heresy is critical. And I say, let us protect the possibility of heresy. Because not every heresy becomes an orthodoxy. But there was no orthodoxy that was not a heresy. And the conditions that we live in today would give us, in fact, for the first time in human history, greater possibility of protecting that space of contestation. Because whenever someone says this is a heresy, what he is saying is, in my view, this is a heresy. But in my view part is never said. So those people who speak in the name of God drop the fact that it is they who are speaking in the name of God or claiming to speak in the name of God. And that is what we need to contest. Mm. To say, yes, you are entitled to speak of your understanding of the word of God. By the same token, I have the right to speak of my understanding of the word of God. And let our arguments work out in the community.
Just to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, we're speaking with Abdullahi Ahmed An-Naim. He's professor of law at Emory University and is a scholar who is well known for writing about Islam and human rights, among other things, and also for arguing for a more liberal modernist understanding of Islam. He is here visiting the campus. He'll be talking on the topic Islam and the secular state, negotiating the future of the religious law of Islam. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. At the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And, of course, anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. These programs are always open to the public and free. Questions are welcome, too. We just ask callers to try to be brief as we move along through the hour so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. But certainly, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone in Bloomington, Indiana, to talk with here. Line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I know the Muslims have a long history of spreading Islam by military conquest, and these conquests often involve mass murder. But it seems to me that when mass murder is as indiscriminate as it has been in Iraq, it backfires. It backfires for two reasons. First, it backfires because people become so outraged that they are willing to risk death in order to oppose the terrorists. That's the first reason it backfires. Second reason it backfires is because the mass murder becomes so indiscriminate that people to yield, even the people that yield to the terror, are just as likely to get killed as people who fight the terror. So why not fight it? You're just as likely to get killed if you yield to it as if you fight it. So why not fight it?
I agree with you that you have to fight terror, and that terrorism is indefensible, whatever the cause, or whatever the alleged justification. But your first claim that Islam was spread through violence and then shifting to Iraq, what's happening in Iraq has nothing to do with the spread of Islam. It's a political problem of a particular community, and that we can trace the origins of the large-scale violence in Iraq today. But the phenomenon of the use of force to propagate ideas is not specific to religion or to Islam. Marxism under Stalin, for example, have committed atrocious murders of massive scale in the name of a secular ideology. And we also have the Holocaust in Europe, in which National Socialism of Nazi Germany massacred millions of Jews and other human beings. So the phenomenon of mass violence is unfortunately very human and true of many traditions. My point is not to defend Islam, because it is not Islam that does anything, it is the Muslims who do. Because Islam is not an entity that acts, it is Muslims who are the agents who act. My point is to say, in every situation, let us understand who are the actors and why are they acting in the way they do, and move away from claims of this is specific to this religion or specific to this society, because it is not true. If Muslims are 1/5 of the total world population, if this is about Islam, we would have a much larger scale of violence all over the world, and not in very specific regions where we know exactly what happened and what triggered the violence in the first place.
You can say what Islam. It may be Muslims who have perpetrated most of the violence, but to say that Islam does not that Muslims have not been more depraved than most other religionists is, I think, false. If you read Surah 9 in the Quran, you can get plenty of justification for some of their mass murder. But throughout history, they have also perpetrated that kind of depraved conduct. As a matter of fact, Muhammad himself personally murdered about 600 Jews. And that's quite a tradition. I mean, it's substantiated in history that they've done that.
Okay, now if I talk about Islam and historical experience with Islam, if you read the Bible, you will find similar phrases and clauses that could be and have been used to justify violence and to justify mass murder too, and that in the history of Christianity also, there have been conquests in the name of propagating the faith. In fact, the establishment of this country, the United States of America, is a direct product of inter-Christian violence in Europe. 30 years of Christian war in Europe that forced people to immigrate to come to this new continent. So, I mean, at this point, I don't think it's a productive position to take to say this is specific to Islam and peculiar to Islam, because historically that is false. It is true about Islam as it is true about other religions. The question that I find more productive is to say, let us try today understand the causes of violence and today respond to it in a way that is really humane and respectful of the human dignity of all human beings. The most recent genocide we had in Africa, in Rwanda. Rwanda, it was an exclusively Christian country. That the 700,000 Rwandans who were killed by other Rwandans were all Christians killed by other Christians. So my point is not to say my religion is worse than yours or yours is worse than mine. I think that is not productive. Let us have a sense of perspective. Let us have a sense of history. And with all due respect, sir, I suggest that if you read the history, you will see that what you complain about is true about other religions and also true about secular ideologies. I mentioned to you the example of Soviet Russia under Stalin in Soviet Russia, which was a secular ideology, I think we have seen a much larger scale of violence and atrocity than we are seeing in Iraq today. And if you look at the Holocaust, which was by Christians of Jews in Europe, and not that far ago, 60, 70 years ago, we would have a better sense of perspective.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're almost at our midpoint here, and I have some others. And I take the point, and I guess I want to second the point about I'm not sure it's very productive to get into talking about who is worse, and who of what faith is guilty or not of committing violence in the name of the faith. What I would like to make sure that people understand is that I think that you personally, as a Muslim, have indeed taken the stand against violence. You said this. Anyone who would argue that Muslims are directed to convert other people by force, this one kind of looking at jihad, you personally are saying this is not right. We need to move away from this. We need to reject that.
Completely. And I have been saying this as part of a movement for 40 years. Mm. I'm 60 years old now. And 40 years ago, I joined a movement that exactly addressed this point. So it is not a phenomenon of post-9/11 or 90s where Muslims are standing up against jihad and against violence. That Muslims have said this and opposed violence and opposed jihad for centuries. And again, in every tradition, which is Islam, it is true too, you have these competing perceptions of the tradition, and you have these competing, and often the conditions surrounding the communities are more determining of how communities react than sort of an abstract notion of what the Quran says. Because if people are instructed by chapter 9, verse 5, the Quran also instructs Muslims to do all sorts of other things. How come they are not doing all the other things that they are supposed to do because the Quran says so, and doing this thing because the Quran says so? I think it is more complex. I would rather move away from claims of exceptionalism, that Muslims are not bad because they are Muslims, and they are not good because they are Muslims. Muslims are human beings, and like all human beings, there is good and there is bad. And there is also ways in which the scripture is interpreted to promote peace and cooperation, and ways in which the scripture is promoted to promote violence. And this is not peculiar to Islam or to Muslims.
We have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Gibson City. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I am just so... Well, first I'm going to thank WRIL for inviting you, and I am just looking forward to hearing you on campus, and I just wish more people could hear you and listen to you. And I agree with you so much. We have our Bible or Quran or Torah or whatever, and as human beings, we read this. And since we read it, we're you know, we don't always read it like we should. And I also believe in nonviolence as a way of settling things. That is my faith belief. And I have worked in the Israel West Bank area, and we go there for nonviolence to help violence from happening and to document human rights violations. And the one thing I discovered is that the Muslims, we don't go there to convert the Muslims, and they don't convert us. And I mean, it's just, but we have this wonderful relationship. And it's been such a wonderful experience for me to just be there and work with the Muslims and the Jewish people that want peace in their land, or lands, I should say. But I just really appreciate what you've been saying about, you know, there's always the radical people in our religions that make our religions look bad. And one of my co-workers look at this way. There's people in the conflict that want to settle it by violence, and others that want to set it, you know, to settle it nonviolently. And I'm just going to hang up and listen to your wonderful words. And again, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just very much to agree with what you said. And I would emphasize that violence never settles anything. That is no resolution can be achieved by violence. It is completely counterproductive. As the earlier speaker said, I agree with that. That is completely counterproductive. Because when you use violence, you are imposing your view on the other side by coercion and force. And it's just a question of time before he or she will come back to contest that. But only by consensus, by actual negotiation, and by living together. And often that is what the extremists want to move away from, which is that how people in their lives make peace every day. And that is a peace that is sustainable.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is line number two and someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I certainly have enjoyed hearing what you've said so far. My father and brother attended Emory University in Atlanta. It's a beautiful and fine institution.
Thank you.
I fully concur with what you said. And I believe that violence begets violence. Also, I think many people, especially in this country, are ignorant of the culture of Muslims. We would not have algebra, for example, if it weren't for the Muslims. We would not have the Greek and Roman classics that were preserved in monastery or some such in Spain if it were not for the Muslims. My professor of architectural history had even attended Muslim services. And he taught us that the medical practice for correcting problems in the eye was so highly developed in the Muslim world that it was never superseded until sometime after, well after, the 19th century. We would not have vaulting in all those beautiful cathedrals in Europe. I could go on and on. Correct me if I'm wrong, please.
No, you are right. And I think, I believe in intercivilizational.
Yes.
Building on each other's experiences and achievements. And for me, it is not a question of claiming credit for this or the other. I think I am a human being, and for me, the human is the ultimate reality that we all share. And we can change our religions, we can change our national affiliations, but our humanity remains. And this humanity, whether it is from Chinese civilization to Muslim civilization to European and Western civilization, is building on each other's experiences and achievements. And so we should not really try to create this competitive attitude of saying Muslims are the best or Europeans are the best. It is not that simple. And again, Muslims, when you say Muslims, as I said, Muslims are 1/5 of the total world population. That is, 1 in every 5 persons is a Muslim. There are Muslims in all parts of the world. There are even, in fact, more Muslims in sub-Saharan Africa than there are Muslims in the Arab world. Arabs make only about 10% of the total Muslim population of the world. There are more Muslims in India, which is a secular state, India, as opposed to Pakistan, India, the country of India. There are more Muslims in India than there are Muslims in any of the countries of the Middle East, or all of them combined almost. So it is, to get a sense, there are more than 40 million Chinese Muslims. So our notion of what Islam is and what Muslims are should not be limited or focus on the Middle East, because there is much more to Islam historically and globally speaking today than what the Middle East would suggest to us.
Yes. I thank you so much. Yes, our professor taught us one of the basic precepts of the faith was tolerance of your fellow man.
It is, and I think of all faiths, it is the case, but always in every faith, you will find people who will rather de-emphasize that and emphasize the confrontational. And I think the confrontational, which is really completely, as you said, violence begets violence.
I again want to thank the caller, and we have another, and we're a little bit past our midpoint here, so I would like to take a moment to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or even 10 minutes. Abdullahi Ahmed An-Naim is professor of law at Emory University. That's in Atlanta. He was born, raised, educated in Sudan. While he was a law student there, he became involved in an Islamic reform movement, had to leave as fundamentalists took over the government. He left. He came to the United States. He worked as the executive director of Africa Watch, which is now the African Division of Human Rights Watch, based in Washington, D.C., and then in 1995 joined the faculty of Emory Law School. He's visiting the campus here to give a talk. I'm sure he'll talk about some of the things that we're talking about here this morning, Islam and the secular state, negotiating the future of the religious law of Islam, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. This is a talk in the MillerCom series, and anyone who is interested should feel welcome to attend. Also, questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, someone on a cell phone. They are next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you very much for the reintroduction. I did just tune in. Could you explain a little bit about the basic difficulties between Sunni and Shia? I'm unclear why there's such strife, and I'll listen to you offline. Thank you.
What we now know as Shia and Sunnis, the initial conflict was in fact a political conflict, and it goes back to the day the Prophet died and before he was buried. That is, the Muslims disagreed immediately. The small Muslim community in Medina, the city where the Prophet died, disagreed as to who is to succeed him. And the Shia are the group who they are known as Shia Ad Ali, that is, the partisans of Ali. They supported that Ali, who was the Prophet's cousin, should be his successor. The other Muslims had other candidates, but eventually Abu Bakr emerged as the majority and successful candidate in that initial contest. But that initially political division among Muslims of the same community continued to develop and started being reflected in the theology and the jurisprudence and in the politics of the region throughout the history of Islam since the 7th century. And the Shia, of course, they themselves also are divided into several sects, as well as the Sunnis also being divided in several groups. Now, the relations between Sunni and Shia, I think that the conflict can always be seen as political that has theological and jurisprudential ramifications. It is fundamentally a political conflict. And, of course, as each side sort of solidified their position and became entrenched, they begin to see the other as heretical, as out of the fold. I think sometimes we can gain understanding if we think of other religions and how different factions within those religions, as Catholics and Protestants, for example, in Northern Ireland, is an understanding of how a political difference become sort of edified into a religious theological difference. Now, most Americans got to know about the Shia and Sunni since the events of Iraq of the last 3-4 years. But we tend to forget that in Iraq, the Shia and Sunni coexisted for centuries. It goes back to the very beginning. In the 8th century, Baghdad was the capital of the Muslim Empire under the Abbasid dynasty. At that time, Shia and Sunni coexisted, often in conflict, sometimes in violent conflict, but not all the time in violent conflict. So it is a political difference that developed into many other features that also reflected and the Sunni sometimes oppressed the Shia, sometimes the Shia oppressed the Sunni. In the 9th and 10th century, Egypt and Tunisia were ruled by a Shia dynasty of the Ismaili Shia, the Fatimid state, which oppressed Sunnis. But most of history, you find that the ebb and flow,
that how one community tends to grow and to become dominant and oppress the other, and the other way also comes down in reverse. I think that how deep and how complex it is, because I don't think that we are serving the cause much by simplifying the dichotomy or the conflict as if it is something recent or something that is necessarily violent. It is ancient, and it has been violent sometimes, but also it has been non-violent sometimes.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about Sharia, about Islamic law, particularly as there are places where people argue that it ought to be the law of the state. And particularly these are people who are arguing, who are concerned with, again, going back to something we talked about in the beginning, concerned with called the dominance of Western culture and their concerns about those values and their rejection of what they see as those values, and who have said that what we ought to do here and wherever it is that we live is that we ought to live according to Islamic law, and that ought to be the law of the state. And you have some interesting things to say about whether or not that's advisable, or perhaps whether that or not that's even possible.
Correct. To start with, maybe one point to clarify is to think of Sharia as a concept versus Sharia as a content. That is, the concept of Sharia is the religious law of Islam, but the content is always a product of human interpretation. It is human beings who interpret what the law, or religious law of Islam is. But that the nature of the religious law is that it is not a state law and cannot be state law. That is the main point I'm making in the lecture tonight, is that Sharia cannot be enacted as a state law. That is, if you take a principle of Sharia and make it a state law, it ceases to be Sharia by the very act of enacting it. It becomes the political will of the state and not the religious law of a community. And in the Quran, you will not find the word state mentioned anywhere. The Quran never mentions the term state or the concept of a state. It is all the Quran speaks to Muslims as believers, as individuals, and to community, but never to the state. The word state does not occur a single time in the whole text of the Quran. So it is a human construction that Muslims from the start believe the state to be necessary, and that I accept, of course, but it is not religious. The state cannot be religious. The state is a political institution. It does not have belief. It does not have a conscience. It cannot believe. The state is a political institution. It has always been. So in my work, I challenge the claim that we can have an Islamic state, that the state cannot be Islamic. I challenge the claim that Sharia can be enacted as a state law, because, as I said, it ceases to be Sharia by enacting it. The nature of religious authority is different from the nature of political authority. And political authority has to be secular, because we as citizens have to be able to contribute equally to making the law. And we cannot be bound by someone's personal view of what the law is, which is what the religious point is. So I think my position is to say that as a Muslim, yes, I am bound by Sharia, but in my belief, in my personal life and practice as a believer. In fact, when the state forced me to comply with what the ruling elite claimed to be Sharia, they are denying me the right to be Muslim by conviction, by my choice and responsibility. So, in other words, I say that I need a secular state to be Muslim. And my claim is that there has never been a religious state throughout Muslim history. And that the state was, the fact that some people call it Islamic does not make it Islamic. Now, here today, we see Saudi Arabia claiming to be an Islamic state, Iran claiming to be an Islamic state. To each other, they are heresies. The Saudis think of Iranians as heretics. The Iranians think of the Saudis as heretics. Mm-hmm. Who has the Islamic state? What does it mean to say an Islamic state when two diametrically opposed ideologies, and there are human ideologies in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, claims to be Islamic? So my point is that as Muslims, we are bound by Sharia, but outside the framework of the state, that Islam and the state must be separate institutionally. That for to allow the state to claim that it can enforce Sharia is corrupting of Sharia and corrupting of the state. The state is a political secular institution that we must strive to keep it political secular. Now, religion will keep coming back through the back door of politics. And I think that we should not have the illusion that by separating religion from the state, we are separating religion from politics. So my claim is that religion and politics are interconnected because believers will act politically as believers. So how to safeguard the secular nature of the state against the political, the religious politics of the community? That is a struggle. And I, for me, constitutionalism, human rights, citizenship, public education, all types of mechanisms and safeguards are to be deployed to protect the secularity of the state. And I, by the way, I emphasize that I speak of a secular state, not a secularized society. There is a difference. To say the state is secular does not mean that society is secular. In fact, my claim is that the state should be secular precisely for the society to be religious. Because the only way you can be religious is by conviction, by freedom of choice, no coercion. If you coerce me, you take away my right to be religious according to my belief.
So you think that it's important for the state to guarantee the right of an individual to be a person of faith, whatever faith, or to have no faith.
Absolutely. Again, logically, you cannot believe unless you can disbelieve. That is, the possibility of disbelief is integral to the possibility of belief. If the only choice is to believe, then it is not belief. So yes, the state has the obligation to protect public safety, to provide essential services, but also to protect the freedom of belief, including disbelief. Because when you say disbelief, it is disbelief in a religion or all religions, but it is a belief in something. Mm-hmm. It could be a secular philosophy, but that's fine. The point is that the freedom of the human being to believe whatever she or he chooses to believe is fundamental to the very possibility of being a religious person. So that's why I say I am calling for a secular state from an Islamic point of view. That as a Muslim, I need a secular state, not as a concession to Western imperialism or Western hegemony. Mm. And the irony is the Islamists are, in fact, enacting European cultural and political hegemony by calling for an Islamic state. Because the state they talk about is a European state. And the law they talk about is a European idea of law. Because when the Muslim societies became independent, they continued with the European model of the nation state, which is centralized, bureaucratic, hierarchical, and coercive. This is different from the historical imperial states with which Muslims lived before colonialism, which were very distant from the life of communities. Now, this centralized, hierarchical, bureaucratic state is a European state. The idea of positive law as opposed to customary or Sharia in the normative sense is also a European idea of law. So the irony is that these people claim self-determination as Muslims by enacting a European idea of the state and a European idea of law. And I would say that self-determination is in context. Our context today is a context where we live with nation states. The nature of the nation state is that it cannot be religious. Because once you allow a religion to take over the state, then you are crowding out the possibility of being a citizen. And the question of being a believer overrides the question of being a citizen. So those are the issues I am struggling with.
We're coming to, we have maybe 2-3 minutes left. Let me ask you to react to this. I'm sure that you would argue that it is not Islam is in no way incompatible with Western or maybe even universal notions of human rights or democracy and what it means to be a citizen to participate in a democratic society. You would say there was no reason why one cannot be a Muslim and hold on to those kinds of ideas.
Absolutely. In fact, I say that as a Muslim, I believe in human rights. So in other words, it's not only that it's not incompatible. For me, and this is not recent, as I said, I'm 40 years working with this. For me, the imperative way of being Muslim is to be committed to human rights, is to be committed to democracy. And that what we see about Islamic societies around the world today is more to do with the post-colonial phenomenon than to do with Islam as such. It is not in the history of Muslims that they could never be other than sort of what you see in terms of authoritarian dictatorial regimes. And so what I say is I try to understand why present Muslim societies are struggling with these issues. And I see also how it is a process that democratization, constitutionalism is not something that you just achieve overnight, wake up one morning and you are democratic constitutional. It took this country almost 300 years, building already on European experiences to establish the level of rule of law and constitutionalism that we have in this country, in the United States. So my point is that long process, every society has to do it, but it doesn't have to be that long. That today's African and Asian Muslim societies can build on the experiences of Western societies. And for me, I don't accept dichotomies of Western and non-Western. For me, the human is human.
Do you believe that Islam is on the verge of a period of change, reassessment? I know you have actually used the word reformation.
Yes, I do believe that, but also I note that you don't appreciate reformation when you are going through it. That is, the Christian Reformation, for the people who were living through it, they did not realize what was happening. It is only in retrospect that now we look back and say, ha-ha, that was the period of Christian Reformation. So even what going through Muslims and whether it will be a reformation or not is for history to tell, or for people in the future to tell. But what I do believe, personally, it is a struggle for myself, my children, and a grandchild also, that I say that I need to struggle. These are the values I stand by. Secular state, human rights, constitutionalism, democracy. I need this to be the Muslim I choose to be. So for me, that is the imperative. And I will do it in my own life and be responsible for it. Now, over time, whether this accumulates into an actual transformative moment remains to be seen.
Yeah. Certainly within Islam, unlike some other faiths, there is no central authority. Mm-hmm. There are different communities, some of them large communities, who may lay claim to having the truth or saying that they're practice, their way of practice is correct. But if there is the kind of change that you're talking about, then what it'll have to come about is through a process of negotiation, debate, conversation, hopefully peacefully, among a lot of different people who may indeed have very different ways of looking at this. Where if this happens, who would lead this reformation, or who is leading this reformation?
I think my point is that, yes, the lack of a centralized theological authority, I take it as a blessing. Because I say that Islam is theologically democratic. Sociologically, Muslims have not been democratic, but Islam theologically, meaning that from a religious point of view, nobody has a monopoly on doctrine. Nobody can tell this is the Islamic doctrine. Of course, a lot of people claim to say that, but nobody has the authority to do it. Mm-hmm. That means we diffuse religious authority among the community. So for me, it is not only that certain. Of course, you have intellectual leaders, political leaders who can inspire and lead people, but it has to be an individual. Every single individual Muslim has to be transformed and or rather transform herself or himself, because transformation cannot happen from without. It has to happen from within. I think so. I think we have conditions now today in which we can be free, secular state, with a secular state, to be free, to be creative, to be transformative. So the possibility is there. The agency is our human agency. And it has to be every single one of us as Muslims who has to do that.
We must stop because we've come to the end of the time for the first hour. Our guest for this hour, Abdullahi Ahmed An-Naim, he's professor of law at Emory University. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate
it. Thank you, David. Thank you.